I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, should kidney donors be paid? A leading transplant surgeon says yes. But first, this morning, Senate Democrats fell one vote short of advancing a bill that contained the first increase in car, truck, and SUV fuel economy standards since 1975. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
This was a good, hard-fought battle. I'm disappointed we didn't pick up one more vote. But I know how difficult it was for some of my Republican colleagues to vote the way they did.
Some Republicans did cross party lines to support the energy bill, which also calls for massive increases in ethanol as fuel. But many in the GOP objected to a key Democratic provision to repeal more than $13 billion in tax breaks to the nation's largest oil companies. Still, New Mexico Republican Pete Domenici called it the most significant energy act that we can take to reduce our dependence on foreign oil and predicted the bill will eventually pass. Well, for the latest, we turn to Dina Capiello, energy reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Dina, how hard-fought has this battle been, you know, behind the scenes?
Oh, this was huge. I mean, this is up to the minute. They're negotiating now as we speak before a vote later today on the bill without the tax provisions. So this is live, and this goes all the way back to January when the House first passed H.R. 6, which now we have two successive amendments on it, and so it's changed quite a bit over the months.
Taxes on the oil industry seem to be the main bone of contention. Why?
Absolutely, because, Republicans and Democrats, Landrieu was the sole Democrat that voted against cloture this morning from Louisiana.
This is Mary Landrieu from Louisiana.
Yes, correct. Are concerned that they're singling out an industry, and they feel that we should do nothing to discourage domestic oil and gas production and refining. And that was their main point of contention, and that goes, again, all the way back to almost January.
Harry Reid says the Senate will take up the bill again. Will it eliminate, what will it contain?
Well, he said this morning on the floor that he is going to take the tax provisions out. However, it will likely include a couple of billion dollars at least to offset the cost of raising fuel economy. As we bring fuel economy, we improve fuel economy, we burn less fuel in our cars, and for the federal government, that means less gasoline tax revenue. So they will have to offset that under the pay-as-you-go rules. But I would be very shocked if we see anything on the oil and gas industry, any kind of subsidy repeals later this afternoon.
Well, but how will Republicans such as Pete Domenici react to that? Because he is calling it the most significant energy act that we can take to reduce our dependence on foreign oil.
I think it's a go. I think that, a lot of the Republicans today in making their comments on the floor said, hey, let's take out the tax title and let's have the CAFE and the renewable fuel standard and get a great bill that can get through both chambers and to the president and one that he'll sign. And I think that's what's going to happen. I mean, the president in his latest statement of administration policy, which came out this morning, said he would veto it over the tax title. He expressed concerns, still very minute concerns about CAFE and the renewable fuels, but that did not come with a veto threat. So it looks fairly good at the moment.
What about the ethanol portion of the bill? Critics say corn isn't an efficient source of new fuel, but it's produced in states like Iowa, so politically important. So is that, guaranteed to be in any bill that goes forward?
At this point, yes. I mean, RFS has strong support on both sides of the aisle. There has been some grumbling about the changes to the fuel standard that were made by the House before it came back over to the Senate. Those largely deal with the transfer to more advanced biofuels, non-corn-based ethanol, cellulosic ethanol that comes from other sources. I think that, you're probably going to see an RFS at the end of this.
You mentioned renewable sources before also, and Harry Reid angered some in his own party for giving up a provision requiring utilities to begin generating electricity from renewable energy sources. But it didn't look as if he lost any votes over that.
Well, no, because they stripped it out. I mean, they stripped that out.
Over the anger. Yeah,
they already said, hey, see ya, we're done with that, because there was a lot of Southeastern lawmakers who said, listen, you know, we can't get to 15% in our states. And if we're required to do this, that's going to be basically a tax increase to consumers who pay energy bills. And that was the big stumbling block. Yeah. That's kind of curious, though, because, you know, RES, a renewable electricity standard or renewable portfolio standard, whatever you want to call it, has passed the Senate before. So it's kind of interesting that that really was a deal breaker this time around.
Dina Capiello, energy reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Dina, thanks so much.
Take care.
If you're a patient waiting for a kidney transplant or a family member watching a loved one struggle through dialysis, you already know the statistics. The average wait for a donor kidney is about 5 years, and 40% of those waiting will either die while waiting or become too ill over those years to receive an organ if one does eventually become available. One problem, the demand for kidneys has escalated. The donation rate has not. To harvest more kidneys, the medical and ethical community has long debated, should organ donors be paid? Well, Dr. Arthur Matus, the director of the kidney transplant program at the University of Minnesota, has spent a quarter century performing kidney transplants, and he says yes. He makes his case in a recent issue of the Cato Institute's Policy Analysis magazine, and we want to spend some time with him today on it. Dr. Matus, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I want to just address first what is the first reaction of many people, you know, selling kidneys. I remember coming across a personal ad 25 years ago, a desperate man who needed money was offering to sell a kidney. You're well aware it conjures up, you know, images of poor people taking a medical risk, losing their dignity for money.
Certainly this sounds awkward at first glance. I think you have to remember two things. One, we already put people through the donation process, and the surgery would be exactly the same as we have for kidney donors. The evaluation would be the same. There's really no difference other than that the donor would get the money, and there's nothing wrong with getting money.
And by the way, the donors that you're referring to that are already exist are family members or friends or, you know,
Correct. Completely
altruistic
Correct.
People who have come forward and volunteered. That's how it works now.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And the second issue is if we don't do something, people are going to continue and to die and suffer on the waiting list, as you mentioned at the beginning. And to me, people suffering and dying on the waiting list sounds worse than the concept of paying people to come forward and offer to be donors.
Well, let's explain that. Why are so many people on the waiting list?
I think it's partly because transplantation has gotten so successful that more patients with kidney failure are opting for transplantation rather than opting to stay on dialysis. So there are more and more people opting for transplantation, yet at the same time, the number of available donors hasn't increased, so that every year we have a longer and longer waiting list and longer waiting time. In some parts of the country, this is getting close to 10 years of waiting.
And dialysis, while a stopgap measure, people can get increasingly ill while they're on dialysis, so it's not the final answer.
Correct. There is no doubt, and there's clear data in the literature, that transplantation provides significantly better quality of life than dialysis and significantly longer quality of life than dialysis.
And by the way, we should say, dialysis does what when a kidney fails?
Well, for dialysis, you have to go down usually to a dialysis center where via a needle in your vein, they take your blood out and purify it and then give it back to you. Now, sometimes this can be done at home, but for the majority of patients in this country, there's a need to go down to a dialysis center 2 to 3 times a week for 3 to 4 hours each time. So just the time constraints alone are a major limiting factor.
So what kind of system are you proposing? I mean, you're certainly not referring to what I saw 25 years ago, you know, personal ads being taken out, people selling their kidneys. How would you set this up to ensure that donors are healthy, that there's no funny business going on? What are you proposing?
Right. So let me tell you what I'm not proposing first, because I think it's very critical to differentiate what I'm proposing from a free market system, which actually is being done in other countries and is being done very poorly. It's a disaster. What I'm proposing is a regulated system where the government, who pays for most of dialysis, by the way, is the buyer of the kidneys, if you were. The government or insurance companies would compensate the donor. and the kidneys would be allocated to the number one person on the waiting list, just the same way as we allocate deceased donor kidneys to the waiting list. So everybody who's on the list would be eligible. This wouldn't be the rich buying from the poor. It would be the government or insurance companies paying for the kidneys, and the kidneys being allocated to all of the people who are waiting.
And when you say the government would compensate, you're not necessarily talking about just money. You've suggested that there might be some sort of barter system. Explain that.
Well, I think that different things are of value to different people. So I think the first thing we have to do is decide that this is a good idea, and then we can argue what the compensation ought to be. But, for example, I think part of it needs to be provision of long-term health care. I think one of the issues, even for today's donor, that's a limiting factor is that many potential donors, people who want to be donors to a loved one or a friend, don't come forward because they're worried that they don't have long-term health care. I think the other part of having long-term health care is that it would allow us to provide long-term follow-up to all the donors to make sure that they're doing well. So I think that's just a given that needs to be part of the system. But in addition, you could have other incentives, such as a tax deduction, a term life insurance policy, a direct payment.
You've even suggested college tuition.
I think the menu of options is potentially infinite. I think what we want to do, though, is create a menu so that there's equivalent value for all the kidneys. Anybody coming forward and offering to do this should get a package of equal value, although it may be that you would choose item one and I would choose item two because... for example, if you had no income, then a tax deduction isn't of much value to you.
This raises so many questions, as you know. I mean, some might say, geez, Americans should all have long-term health care anyway. They shouldn't have to sell a kidney to get it.
I agree with that.
You might agree with that. But when it comes to, let's say, college tuition, I mean, that's where this dark image comes up of somebody who's desperate and poor and puts themselves in what's a dangerous medical situation. It's not always, you know, scot-free when you donate a kidney just to get something in return. You've written that poverty doesn't coerce. Why doesn't it?
Well, I think individuals coerce. I mean, coercion's an interesting thing. Coercion's when you put a gun to somebody's head and give me your money or else. And I understand what the question is if somebody is in a situation of poverty, does that force them to make bad decisions? And I would argue that it puts them in a situation where there may be tough decisions, but we all have to make tough decisions. And so the question really becomes, if selling a kidney really is the best choice for them, if they really get something in return that can make a difference in their lives, is this such a bad idea? And I think that's just another way to look at it. I think you have to remember that, number one, we do this operation at our hospital 3 or 4, sometimes 5 times a week. So the operation is exactly the same. We do the evaluation on the donors, and we feel comfortable we can screen out the healthy and the non-healthy. And the fact is that people who are poor are put in all sorts of situations where they have to make decisions that perhaps those who are not poor don't make. They take on jobs that are higher risk, including oil rigs or policemen, firemen. I mean, there are people who put themselves at risk every day for money, and some of those people we call heroes.
Dr. Arthur Matus is director of the Kidney Transplant Program at the University of Minnesota. When we come back, how much should donors be paid? Also later, Germany tried to ban Tom Cruise, now wants to ban the whole Church of Scientology. That's later. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We've been talking to Minnesota kidney transplant surgeon Dr. Arthur Matus, who says that the best way to get dialysis patients off waiting lists for life-saving transplants is to pay donors for their kidneys. Now, his soon-to-be-published article in the Journal of Clinical Transplantation calls for a compensation package that would include a 1-year life insurance policy worth $1 million, lifetime health care, travel expenses, pay for work lost, and other benefits, a package totaling about $95,000, or, he says, donors could just be given that cash. He has his critics. Dr. Matus, let's get to that. You write that the system already in place to screen donors who now donate to friends and family and to harvest kidneys from deceased donors would be used to screen these paid donors. And you say there's a convincing argument to be made that there's legal precedent, that people already donate blood or sperm and eggs for money. But two doctors counter in the journal Nephrology that, first of all, removal of a kidney is a much more invasive procedure requiring serious surgery. They also say paid donation is too seductive. They cite examples of people abroad who donate a kidney and then were willing to donate their second kidney and go on dialysis. That's how much they wanted the money.
Well, I think, number one, people make alarmist arguments about this. And part of our job as physicians is to make sure that the donor is cared for and protected. And obviously, we're not going to allow someone to donate two kidneys and put themselves at risk. But again, as I mentioned before, the surgical risk of living donation is something we have people go through on a regular basis across this country at all transplant centers. There's no doubt that there is a surgical risk, and our job is to inform people about the risk, make sure they understand that risk, and then allow them to make the decision whether or not to go forward. The argument that we already pay people for body parts such as, say, hair or sperm is perhaps not a particularly good argument, but the fact is we do pay people for eggs, which involves an anesthesia and has some risk, and we do pay people to be surrogate mothers, which also has some risk. So there is definitely a precedent set for payment in situations where there is risk.
What in your mind are some of the other far-reaching benefits of paid kidney donors? You already mentioned the overarching one, which is that lives would be saved. But, you know, for instance, cost.
I think cost is one benefit. I wouldn't want to make the argument that we should do this because of cost. Certainly, a successful transplant is far cheaper for the government and for insurance companies than dialysis.
You would say, in fact, that paying for kidneys would ultimately save Medicare $95,000 per transplant? Is that compared?
I think keeping someone off dialysis saves Medicare $95,000. That means we could use $95,000 per transplant for the compensation package, including the administrative costs and the payment to the donor, mm-hmm. compensation for the donor, could be $95,000, and the whole system would be cost neutral to the government. So in that sense, I think there's a benefit. I would argue the other benefit is that if we had a regulated system of compensation in this country, it would prevent people from going to other countries where these terrible, terrible markets occur, something that we call transplant tourism, where neither the donor nor the recipient are protected. And I think that would be an additional benefit. I think all of us in transplantation would love to see these free market systems in other countries eliminated. And by providing more kidneys here, there'd be fewer people traveling overseas to these other systems.
By the way, do you think that all kidney donors should be reimbursed? You mentioned that, you know, coercion is sometimes an issue in families where
sure.
somebody feels, well, they should do something. I mean, how do you view paying strangers versus paying family?
I think that we all agree, people who are on both sides of this debate agree that there should be no disincentives for being a donor. So, for example, as we talked about earlier, all donors should have health care. You could argue everyone in this country should have health care. We all agree that donors shouldn't have to pay for their own travel expenses. Normally, donors have to go to the transplant institution for their evaluation, and then they have to go a second time at their own expense for the surgery. Now, they don't have to pay for the cost of the surgery, but they have to pay for the cost of travel. They lose the time out of work, et cetera. And we all would like to see all of those disincentives removed for everyone. But I think once we start providing financial incentives for non-family members or people who donate to the list, there may be a need to also provide some incentives for people who are family members. And you could think of it as a two-tiered system. Maybe you'd have some incentive, such as provision of health care to everybody, but provision of health care plus another incentive for people who are donating to the list.
Finally, Doctor, we began by saying that some people worry that paying people to donate a kidney sort of robs them of their dignity. You say that it should be everyone's responsibility to create a culture of dignity for compensated donation. What do you mean by that?
I think we ought to treat all of our donors with dignity. Donors are heroes just as firemen and policemen who are also paid are heroes, and there's no reason they shouldn't be rewarded. And I think the fact that payment doesn't make them any less heroic. And I think we can do that with this system as well. I think all of our donors ought to be treated as heroes, and whether or not they're paid is sort of irrelevant. And I think it's our job, if we create such a system, to create that culture of dignity.
And I have to ask you, you are someone who performs the transplants. critics might say, oh, you just want to do more because then people like you and other people in the medical field make more money when you're performing transplants as opposed to when people are on dialysis.
I think that's an easy criticism to make, but I think it's got little to do with trying to do what's best with our, for our patients. It's really such a small consideration in the big picture. All of us in this field are watching our patients suffer and die while waiting for a transplant, and that's really what the focus is here.
Do you really think, I mean, how many, what's your dream? How many people do you think might come forward if this new paid system was set up?
My dream would be that there would be no waiting list for a transplant in this country.
And what's the waiting list now?
75,000 people.
Dr. Arthur Matus, director of the Kidney Transplant Program at the University of Minnesota. He wrote A Gift of Life Deserves Compensation. To read his article in Policy Analysis, the publication of the Cato Institute, go to our website, here-now.org. Dr. Matus, thanks very much.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, with so many baby boomers eyeing retirement, why aren't the presidential candidates talking more about Social Security? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, a baby name consultant. Parents are paying her to help them pick out a name. That's after the news, Here and Now. The government of Germany has launched an investigation it hopes will lead to a ban on the Church of Scientology within German borders. Officials call the church an unconstitutional organization that suppresses individuality, brainwashes vulnerable minds, and plots to take over the world. A spokesperson for the Berlin chapter of the church called the remarks absurd and promised a legal battle. This is a sharp escalation of a decades-long rift between the government and Scientologists. Scientology's founder was a critic of Germany, and that feud took on extra heat earlier this year in a battle over a Tom Cruise film. Well, joining us from his office at the newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung in Munich is Andrian Kreyer, the arts and cultural editor there. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We know Scientology was founded in the 50s here in the U.S. by science fiction writer L. Ron Hubbard. It's very popular in Hollywood. Actors Tom Cruise, John Travolta are members. It arrived in Germany in 1970, and we know that L. Ron Hubbard had some, well, they've been characterized as bizarre claims about a German conspiracy of psychiatrists against him in the church. But why else is there this particular tension between Germany and Scientology? Where does that come from?
Very multifaceted. Germans react very fearful and allergic against anything that they suspect has a totalitarian either structure or ideology. And they see the core belief of Scientology as somewhat similar to totalitarian systems, and that's why they're very much afraid of it. And that's why the opposition to Scientology in Germany is so fervent.
And doesn't Germany even have written into its constitution laws against groups that they feel are totalitarian?
Yes, there's many laws that were written into the constitution and the regular legal system in Germany that are designed to avoid any even just currents that led to the rise of the Third Reich. For example, there's still a law against giving the Hitler salute. There's still a law against doubting the Holocaust. So any of those things that in other countries are just considered ugly and annoying are here actually illegal.
Well, what does Germany say about Scientology that they say fits that category?
Scientology, in their point of view, and it's proven that it does have some totalitarian structures, there is, if you talk to specialists, forms of brainwashing inherent in the system of Scientology. And then there's, of course, numerous cases where people who wanted to either drop out of the organization or criticize the organization from either within or from the outside were put under pressure with different methods of more, some legal, some not so legal.
Well, Der Spiegel, another newspaper in Germany, outlined in 1995 a plan they said was a plan by the Church of Scientology to undermine the German economy, to bring discredit to the country. This was based on information from an ex-Scientology member named Robert Von Jung, who said there was something called Operation Snow White, a Scientology program to undermine Germany?
There were efforts by the Church of Scientology to rise to power in local governments and to also amass real estate that was considered strategic in several cities. And then also there is a form of striving for world power in the Scientology scriptures or literature, or however you want to call it. So that was seen as a real threat to the state of Germany.
Well, that brings us to the spat with Tom Cruise. Earlier this year, Scientologist Tom Cruise started filming his movie Valkyrie in Germany. Tell us about the character that he was playing and why that is so important to Germans.
Klaus von Stauffenberg was probably the only pure hero in that part of German history. He led the famed July 20th plot in 1944 to kill Hitler with a bomb, and that failed, so he was executed the next day in the Bendler Block in Berlin. Being the only pure hero of that part of German history, people are very protective of that story. So they are kind of reluctant to let the so-called dream machine of Hollywood take over that story and probably tell it for the first time to the whole world, because a film with Tom Cruise in the lead will be shown all over the world.
And it's not just the Hollywood dream machine, it is a Scientologist. Was that as big a factor?
That was an added factor, because they said now there's somebody who is an outspoken face of the Church of Scientology playing this hero of our history, and we don't know what that means. Maybe there's some ideology of Scientology built into this movie, and maybe that whole combination drags down this part of German heroism in the Third Reich.
Well, the government, which had initially refused Cruise access to some sites, later relented. The film has been filmed. But I'm just wondering, there seems to be a disconnect here. We understand that Germans flock to films starring Tom Cruise or John Travolta. They buy music from Scientologist Chick Corea, who was at one point banned from performing there. What does the average citizen think about this new move to try to ban the entire church?
Well, it was mostly politics and tabloid media who would sentiment against Tom Cruise or John Travolta flared up, and that has been the case in the past 20 years or the past 15 years. So that came up again and again and again, and people are very adverse against Scientology, and there was some backlash against Tom Cruise and Travolta and all the other people. But in the end, of course, this whole affair helped Scientology more than it hurt them, because the discussion and the debates became so ridiculous and so overheated that people at the end had to see, you know, in Germany, Scientology is a marginal organization. They have like 5,000-6,000 members.
Well, we understand that even German intelligence agencies are warning the Interior Ministry there that there's such a small footprint, they probably can't gather enough evidence, which is what they're doing right now, to support this ban. So, I mean, is there a sense that it's not going to be, the ban won't be implemented?
It's not going to happen, but it is very helpful for a conservative party that has the word Christian in its name. The CDU is called Christian Democratic Union, in upcoming elections to score major points with their conservative and Christian electorate if they go against a group that is portrayed here as a group of faith that has criminal intent. So you also have to be careful that Scientology, of course, uses the government's efforts to ban them or the Secret Service surveillance that happened here before for their own use, because they can portray themselves as, you know, I mean, what better propaganda plot for a controversial faith than being persecuted in Germany as a group of faith?
Andrian Kreie is the arts and culture editor for the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. Andrian, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
And we have a couple of items from next week's docket. Are guns from rural America shedding blood in America's cities? New York's Mayor Bloomberg says yes, but now gun shop owners in Georgia are responding. Also, testing toys for lead. That's all next week. You're listening to Here Now. what to name a newborn. There are books, opinionated relatives, and now a consultant. Jennifer Moss founded BabyNames.com. Her website gets over 1.5 million hits a month. She offers a half-hour telephone consult for a $95 fee and online surveys for free. Jennifer, what advice do you give parents outside of, you know, relatives' names to get them to think about names?
Look into your past. You know, who's been important to you your whole life? Heroes, great teachers, the books you love, and the characters.
Well, the study of names is called onomastics, and I'm online right now in the part of your website where people just kind of ask for your opinion. For instance, someone says, what do you think about the name Casper? I'm of European heritage. I love the name, but I'm not sure how it's received in the U.S. And you answered what?
I answered that it was associated with the children's cartoon Casper the Ghost.
Right.
Because that's the most pop culture reference that comes to mind.
And that kids might get teased.
Especially if they're extremely pale.
What are the more popular names right now?
On the boys' side, the names that are most popular with our members are Aiden, Braden, and Caden. For girls, Gaelic and Celtic names have been in style for about the past 10 years, but now for girls, biblical names are coming back into style and more traditional turn-of-the-20th-century names, what we call the grandmother names, like Abigail and Madeline and Emma and Olivia.
Someone's even asking you online, I'm seeing, about the country, Ireland, as a first name.
You know, a lot of place names are becoming popular, such as Paris or London or Ireland.
We also understand family surnames are being used as first names. We see, you know, our fearless leader is Kathleen McKenna. McKenna is one of the more popular ones. What are some other last names being used as first names?
Yeah, a lot of them, like Harrison and Jackson. I think families are starting to use family surnames as first names in order to honor their previous generations instead of using first names. In fact, we did the same thing for my daughter, Miranda, which already happened to be a first name, but it was my husband's mother's maiden name.
Well, and they're also strong, solid names. We're reading the Christian Science Monitor. Albert Mehrabian, who's a University of California professor and wrote the baby name report card, he, you know, tested the names and the impact they have on people. And people do associate certain traits with certain names. And the stronger and more grounded the name, a McKenna, a Cooper, for a girl in particular, they view her differently.
Yes, and we've also noticed a trend of unisex names, boys' names crossing over to girls' names. For example, Madison, which was so popular for a while, and the name Jaden and Hayden, which had started as boys' names and have quickly crossed over to the girls' sector. And we think that is because parents want to put their girl children on the kind of the same playing field as the boys.
Do parents actually say to you, I want the kind of name that my girl could have and grow up to be, you know, a CEO or an athlete? You know, I want an, they do.
Yes. And, you know, on the other hand, there was a parent who wanted to name their daughter Pixie, and I discouraged them from doing that because it's kind of an expectation name. They're expecting the child to be small and cute and lithe, and, you know, what if they don't live up to that? What if they want to be a CEO? Can you imagine a CEO named Pixie?
Well, I suppose it could happen, but well, what are some of the other names that parents have wanted that you've had to sort of gently say no?
Well, some of the things that we discourage parents from doing is, you know, rhyming names for their twins, and like I said, expectation names like the name Honesty or something like that. We've heard of parents naming their child ESPN after the sports channel, and obviously that's putting a pretty high expectation on a son to be an athlete.
And plus, what, you know, are they called Espen?
I've heard them called Espen, yes.
The good news for all these kids who are being named is that they can change them, because you are also catering to adults who, in later in life, who want to change their name, who feel it's just not a good fit.
Like adults that want more contemporary names, that feel that their name, like Susan or Nancy, are a little too old-fashioned, or date them. Or people who are emigrating to the U.S. from foreign countries and want a, quote, Americanized name as well.
Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Moss, founder of the website BabyNames.com, so you could do that. Or if you need a name for a newborn, you could ask an aunt. They know everything. That's in 1 minute, here and now. And Kent says we're called here in Boston weren't called much of anything until the 1700s, at least according to a new definitive book. They were ignored by many sociologists and writers. A number of languages still don't even have words to describe them. But ants can be powerful. Writers Virginia Woolf and Jane Austen were both very active ants. And then, of course, there's the fictional ants. Annie M., Aunt Mame, Tom Sawyer, and Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm both lived with ants. Harry Potter had an evil ant. He inflated her like a balloon and sent her to the ceiling. Ants are now given their due in the complete book of ants. And joining us from London, author Rupert Christensen, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome to you.
And for the American edition, Rupert had help from reporter Beth Brophy, who joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome to you, Beth.
Thank you.
And Rupert, I want to begin with you because you begin the book with the question a four-year-old posed, why are there ants? It's a tough answer.
Well, it is, and of course, you know, there is no reason why there should be ants because some cultures just simply don't bother with them. And it's almost as though European culture invented them in the 18th century and suddenly decided to take interest. Why that should be, I don't quite know.
Well, you're right. There were some early references in ancient Greece, etc., but then a thousand or so years, and then boom, the Victorian era was their finest hour. Why?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's the time when women started going out to work. And they couldn't get married and have a job, but certainly in this country.
At least at a certain pay scale, because, of course, there are a lot of women, you know, slaving away in factories and such.
Yeah, I'd say professional women. Mm-hmm. But those women who didn't get married, of course, they had those maternal urges, if you like, which they then channeled into their nieces and nephews.
Now, Beth, in England, ants, have this storied history that Rupert writes about. Did you find the same thing here, though?
In the United States, ants have always played a role in novels and in popular culture. In advertising, we have Aunt Jemima, we have Spider-Man and his aunt. When I started looking into it, I found that several famous authors like Tolstoy and Truman Capote and Proust had close relationships with their aunts. But I don't know that it's ever been as much a part of popular culture as people's primary relationships with, say, their grandparents or their parents.
Here in this country. But Rupert, as you write, they often accomplished great deeds in addition to, you know, just spoiling their nieces and nephews.
Well, there's an extraordinary example of that in the late 18th century in England, a woman called Caroline Herschel. She became a famous astronomer. And she discovered several galaxies. But she was also a very, very enthusiastic aunt. And the great joy of her life, I think, was that her nephew also became a famous astronomer.
Yeah. You write that after the Second World War, people tired of ants. But isn't that when the BBC came to be known as Auntie?
Well, it was known as Auntie because it got this reputation of being rather old-fashioned, rather prim, rather proper, so people called it Auntie. And I don't know if it's the same is true in the United States, but I know that my friends don't really like being called Aunt now by their nieces and nephews. There's something about that word which is just a little bit frousty. You know, you call your aunt just by her Christian name.
Well, I don't know.
And I feel that's the end of an era, you know.
Well, I think in the United States, even though people are less formal and they might call their aunt by their first name, I don't think there's any stigma or shame to being an aunt.
And yet you do write, the age of the great aunt is over. Well, you haven't been to my house. there's a sense of aunts as, you know, somebody exciting that, let's face it, as many of the women in the book say, I had the kids just a little bit at a time. I didn't have to have the day-to-day with the kids. So they have, you know, they're sort of more exciting. They sometimes can lead more exciting lives. But aunts also sometimes have to take over for parents.
Well, they do. And, of course, a very famous case of that, which is in the book, is John Lennon's Aunt Mimi. John Lennon's mother, Julia, didn't really take any interest in him when he was a baby and virtually sort of handed the boy over to her sister. And she brought him up, and she brought him up good and proper, I can tell you. And meanwhile, Julia, the birth mother, would come and visit John once a month and take him out. So it was like a sort of reversal of roles, really.
Who knew how many roles ants played? I mean, you have a whole chapter on X-rated ants. We're not going there today. But there's also evil ants. And I mean, you know, I had forgotten how many. I mean, James and the Giant Peach, for instance, the peach rolls over all those evil ants.
Yes, but actually I think the most famous bad ants at the moment are probably those two sisters of Marge Simpson in The Simpsons, aren't they?
Patty There's an and evil Selma. Aunt in Harry Potter, I believe,
and,
right?
Well, Harry Potter's Aunt Petunia as well, yes. But I think those two aunts in The Simpsons just brilliantly embody really sort of dreary, downbeat aunts, the ones who sort of come around every day and just sit on the sofa and tell children off.
This is a far deeper book than I thought it might be. You even tell stories of people who have written about their aunts who just had terrible times with them. I mean, they can be so powerful for nieces and nephews, but they can also be destructive.
Well, yes, that was certainly true of orphans, I think, you know, who were sent to live with their aunts. And unlike John Lennon's aunt, Mimi, those women did not wish to have these children parked on them and gave them a really, really terrible, miserable time. There are many, many memoirs of this written in the Victorian era. And, of course, aunts, as well as being exotic and eccentric, could really be quite fearsome at times, I think. I don't think they're fearsome anymore, are they?
Actually, Beth, I'm going to ask you. First of all, are you an aunt or do you have one?
Both. I have 8 nieces and nephews. But I have to say that until I worked on this book, I had never really given much thought to the role of aunts, either in my own family or in American life. And what I was heartened by was in modern times, people don't live with their grandparents nearby or aunts and uncles the way I know I was raised within probably an hour of a lot of my aunts and uncles. But you can still find, anecdotally, people who are almost like the surrogate mothers to their nieces and nephews.
Yeah, no, we should actually take a second and define an aunt, because the definition can be broad. It doesn't necessarily have to be an aunt in many cases. It's a family friend who's a woman, an older woman.
I think it's quite interesting that if you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, it seems to be that honorary aunt, as it were, is the original meaning of the word. That's an older meaning of the word than blood aunt. And it applies to any older woman who was in your village or community. Shakespeare actually occasionally uses the word aunt. They're not blood aunts. They're just women you know who are around the corner who you pop into if you need something.
Well, who knew? There was so much to be said about aunts. Rupert, the closing remarks in the book are from you. You pay tribute to your Aunt Janet.
Yes, well, she's really the reason I wrote the book. I was enormously fond of her, and I owe her an awful lot because she did open up my world. She brought me a lot of literature, a lot of music, and we always had a wonderful time together. But when she died, I felt I'd never really thanked her for it. I'd never really drawn up the account sheet of how much I owed her, and this is, in a way, a tribute to her. It's a way of paying her back.
Well, you know, and interestingly enough, she didn't have an outsized life.
No.
She lived in a small cottage, nicotine-stained walls, as you write, you know. What was it?
Just, I think she had a lot of love to give, and we were there ready to receive it. It's as simple as that, you know.
That's all it takes.
That's all it takes.
Yeah. That's Rupert Christensen. We've also been speaking with Beth Brophy. He wrote the complete book of ants, and she added information for the American version. It really is a delight, and I thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.